The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm Neil Zacharias, and you're listening to Eat for the Planet. On this show, we try to answer the question, how can we eat in a way that nourishes us without starving the planet? The show features conversations with food industry leaders, health and sustainability experts, as well as entrepreneurs and creative minds who are redefining the future of food. My guest on this episode is Louisa Burwood Taylor, a food and agriculture journalist focused on new technology and startup investment. We discuss the latest food tech and ag tech trends and explore what's getting the most funding and why. We cover the opportunities and risks in this space, including what negative externalities aren't being accounted for as we reimagine the food system. Lastly, we discuss what the future of food may look like and explore different potential scenarios given current trends. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Louisa Burwood Taylor, thank you so much for joining us on the Eat for the Planet podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Louisa, so you cover the food tech space and obviously talk to a wide range of entrepreneurs, investors, and others who are working on some really interesting solutions to some of the big, hairy, challenging issues facing our food system today. And then this is a pretty broad question, I'm warning you, but what are some of the most interesting new trends that show not just the most promise in terms of their viability, but also seem to be attracting the most amount of funding? One would say both would lead to the same things, but they're not. That's not always the case. So what's the most interesting, and do you think the funding is going to the most interesting things that show the most promise?
Great question. Definitely not a simple one, you're right. I mean, I'm going to start with the second half of that question because it's sort of easier to go, you know, looking at the numbers to start with. And we just did a bit of a deep dive on mid-year data for 2021 and where investment's going. And it's still sort of the, you know, the usual suspects in terms of e-grocery, that is, you know, by far the biggest category across geographies. I mean, there's some particularly big rounds in China that happened the first half of this year, but we have cut that out and looked, and it's still, you know, very decent in other parts of the world. And while it's not, you know, the most exciting, you know, it's certainly very impactful. And I think there's a lot to be done in the grocery space to improve efficiencies, to make sure that there's a breadth of products that are available. And obviously, it's been such a vital service during the pandemic. So e-grocery is interesting, maybe a little bit kind of more boring to cover, perhaps. But, you know, it's definitely one of the biggest areas. What's been really exciting to see, though, in the wake of pandemic and last year, a big trend that we saw in investment figures was that upstream innovations. And those are the ones which are closer to the farmer, in the supply chain, anything related to food production. And we do include alternative proteins and innovative food there. But that was the first year where investment into upstream technologies overtook those that are downstream, closer to consumer. And I think that really reflected an increasing comfort and interest by investors in some of those categories, which have typically been more complicated, more nuanced. So we are talking about biotechnologies. We're talking about supply chain technologies, innovative foods, indoor farming, robotics, and so on, farm robotics. And, you know, a lot of those are incredibly exciting and very, very diverse, you know, even within biotech. You're looking at gene editing, you're looking at biological alternatives to pesticides and synthetic fertilizers. So it's very broad, but looking within all of those, I'm quite excited about various different models within a lot of those different categories.
If I were to sort of categorize the innovations that are getting funding into one as, and this might not be a perfect way to bucket them together, but I'll give it a shot and see if it makes sense. One is breakthrough. I've been talking about it in context of breakthrough technologies versus adaptive technologies. And so when I think of a lot of the supply chain, robotics, farm tech or ag tech technologies, they tend to be sort of leaning towards more adaptive technologies that are not just about minimizing carbon output or improving soil health, but are also sort of about dealing with the inevitable and current impacts of climate change. Versus in the other category, I put breakthrough technologies. One that is, let's just say, alternative proteins probably qualifies as a breakthrough technology because it's about redefining what meat would look like if it's cultured in a bioreactor versus from a farm with animals. If I don't know if these categorizations are absolute or accurate even, but if you look at it from that lens, how much of the attention from an investment standpoint seems to be going into how do we improve on our current system, make it more resilient, help it deal with changing weather patterns, improve soil health, just improve the output of land and freshwater use in agriculture versus things that are like, we're going to redefine what protein means to us and for the food system?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I'm so glad you brought up that distinction between breakthrough and adaptive. You know, I might even argue that maybe the alternative protein space is not that breakthrough necessarily. You know, a lot of the plant-based industry, I think, is tapping into essentially existing commodity markets. If you think about some of the products are using soy being conventionally grown, soy is one of the world's most destructive crops to grow and a leading cause of deforestation. So what I'm finding more exciting, and I don't necessarily know that the dollars are going there yet, but I think investors are increasingly looking. So, you know, even more transformational, and that's like really, truly novel proteins. So think about aquatic plants. And there's a few companies I've been speaking to recently that are doing this. And not only is that those aquatic plants could replace soy in plant-based foods, in animal feeds, you know, there's all this talk about having to replace animal agriculture. I think it's highly unrealistic that's going to happen in the next 10 years or even longer. And we have got quite a dramatic climate crisis at the moment. So I think it's really interesting, exciting when you have companies that are looking to improve the animal agriculture industry. And I think that's very necessary. So by finding new novel types of feed for animals, such as aquatic plants, and the way it's being produced. So there's some companies that are deploying units on farms. So for dairy farms, this company called Phyto, they have these units, they deploy on farms. It utilizes the manure from the cattle as the media for the lemna to grow in. And so there's a circular economy there. They can also have a byproduct of biofertilizers, which can feed back onto the farm. And they're replacing soy one for one, or even more. They're replacing about 30 to 40% of the typical feed that those cows are typically eating, a lot of that which would be soy. The transportation of that feed, because you're localizing it all, you're getting rid of a lot of the carbon emissions from the transportation. There's also some carbon sequestration that can be happening there, particularly as you're utilizing that manure. So that's much more transformative. You're creating a whole new commodity cycle, I guess you could say, commodity market, or I'm not sure the right phrase there, but you're creating a whole new system. And I think increasing as investors start to understand these supply chains or supply webs, as people call it now, I think you're going to see more interest in those sorts of transformations.
You said a lot of really interesting stuff there, and I think I want to pick up on the point about whether certain new technologies that are positioned as breakthrough are truly breakthrough versus some that may at first glance seem merely marginal improvements, like changing the feed or creating a new market for aquatic plants as animal feed, may actually turn out to be more breakthrough from a sustainability standpoint. So which then kind of brings me down to the, you know, what problem are we tackling, right? I think we sometimes fail to ask that question. And people end up arguing whether we need to replace animal agriculture versus improve it, when they're both not even trying to achieve the same thing. They're coming at it with two different, I would say, value sets. If you step back and you look at the breadth of solutions that exists out there, what are the bulk of them trying to solve? Is it all trying to mitigate the impact of climate change, reduce greenhouse gases, and improve the resilience and the sustainability of the food system? Or are they trying to rebuild it from the inside out? Like, what is driving the change? What is the when an investor is putting money into a company, what problem do they think they're trying to solve at a high level?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So the thesis has shifted. So when I first started reporting on agriculture in 2013, it was all about growing more with less. It was about this growing population. I mean, honestly, I've had a dime for the amount of times I've heard about the 10 billion people on the planet and so on. It was all about how can we be more efficient, grow more with less. That's shifted. And so whether it's, you know, digital tools that can help you deploy precision agriculture, or whether it's a new type of fertilizer that gives you bigger yields, the conversation shifted now, and it's more about how can you grow better, and whether that's nutritionally better or environmentally better. And I think for investors now, you know, ESG as a concept is now table stakes. If they want to attract any LPs to their funds, they need to have some ESG messaging. And so a lot of the startups have slightly pivoted their offerings to focus now more on that in environmental side of things. You know, really great example, and I think this is a brilliant company, is Benson Hill. And they, you know, in the crop genetics space, they have created a computational biology platform that other companies could use to discover traits for crops, various different traits. And they also had their own gene editing tool, CRISPR 3.0, I think they called it. But then they shifted the business model essentially to focus on plant protein. And they have used traditional breeding, so they're actually not using any of the gene editing tools, to grow soybean with a high protein content. And they have actually even gone downstream and, you know, acquired processing plants. They want to sort of protect the provenance of that soy. And they've gone downstream to protect that. And they're now essentially becoming a soy protein provider, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting from like a tech standpoint. But, you know, they're doing a SPAC. They did a great deal on that. They got a valuation of $1 billion. So I think it's just really interesting how, you know, the companies, and of course they're going to do that, but the startups are pivoting to that. So another example is with carbon. You know, I've seen quite a few startups, for instance, in aerial imagery, have pivoted their offering from being a tool to help farmers manage their growing season and give them insights about, you know, issues in their fields and so on. And they might still be doing that, but a lot of them have added on this carbon monitoring service. And it's still very early days for carbon, and we can maybe get into that. You know, I don't have a huge amount of knowledge, but I know it's early days, and I know a lot of people are wondering how it's going to play out. But they've started adding on carbon monitoring and flying over fields to be able to verify whether this farmer has shifted some of his practices. He stopped tilling, or he's started using cover crops and so on. So obviously this is the nature of startup land, is that you can be very nimble and do those pivots. And I think, you know, whenever we write an article today about carbon, it's probably going to be one of the best read of the week. And it could be quite interesting. I should do like an analysis what it was in different years. You know, in 2015, it was drones. If I wrote anything about drones, it would be the best read article of the week. 2016 was indoor ag, 100%. Everyone was obsessed with that. Then, you know, we got into what were some of the other ones? I can't think now, like artificial intelligence, and then regenerative agriculture. That was last year. And then this year is carbon. So, you know, I think that's really telling. And it's and often, you know, people come to AgFunder News as a place to learn, you know, new investors might come there. And so I think some of those stats are really telling about what they've potentially been told to like go out and research.
I also think that, you know, you mentioned the 10 billion thing by 2050. I've been guilty of that for the past 5 years. I've stopped talking about it too much lately, but it was all about where the population is growing and we're running out of resources. And there's some truth to that, you know, but it's not the complete picture. But it does bring up the question of time horizons. How useful are they? Should we look at 2050? Should we look at, I often throw 2050 because I think by then, if you haven't solved some of these problems and gotten better, we're probably going to be in a much worse off place than we are right now. So are time horizons even worth talking about? And I'll give you one prompt before we get to that, which is, for example, in the cultivated meat or cell-based ag space, time horizons seem to be a big conversation, right? It's always, how soon is this going to happen? How much of conventional meat will it ever replace? And opinions vary widely. Something people as recently said it's never happening, while others say it'll happen by 2030. So just time horizons in general, and maybe you can pick one or two specific technologies and say how useful they are as a measuring stick, because I'm sure investors, when they're pitched about this, are being offered time horizons. Otherwise, why would they put their money into companies?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I'm not sure I particularly have a good answer for you. I often use that 2050 as a sort of, you know, future looking, how transformed is the system going to be by that year? But, you know, I think we often have to look at the time horizons that the climate scientists use. You know, I think 2030 is quite a big year for some of the targets. And so I think a lot of startups should be using a lot of those horizons, I would imagine, if they are focused on having a climatic impact. It's exciting to see in the 8 years or so I've been covering this. In the early days, indoor ag, and as I mentioned, I think it was 2016, any article would be, you know, blow up the internet if you wrote about indoor ag, and it's certainly gotten a huge amount of column inches across mainstream media. But it's always been interesting because actually the real impact has been so small. So I think now I need to try and remember this, and maybe have to fact check me on this. But indoor agriculture accounts for just 30 hectares of farmland globally, and there are hundreds of millions. And it's always been really interesting because you would never imagine that if you read the press and if you saw how much money has been going into this space. However, I would say that we're at a bit of a pivotal moment for indoor agriculture, and I think it is starting to be, an interesting industry that is starting to supply a decent amount of produce. You're seeing some scalability. You're seeing companies have more than one farm. You've got companies like InFarm in China, and they're deploying the grow cabinets into retailers. It's a very scalable model. So I think it's now less about the promise. I think they've figured out some of the unit economics. The economics around indoor ag has always been something that's been very challenging. So the thing with, I think, ag tech and food tech is that probably for VCs and coming from consumer industries and so on, the timeline is totally different. And it's very hard. I think it's been quite hard to predict in many ways, particularly because you're working with natural systems. And so some of the unknown challenges, could have been unexpected and unforeseen. So, it's interesting. It's just exciting that it's starting to happen now. And I think when I think about the questions that I want to ask companies now, it's changed from like, what's the potential of this technology? How are you building it? And now it's like, okay, so what are your revenues? Like, what are you actually doing? Are you actually having an impact? And I was on a panel the other day for the Rethink World AgriTech. And I was asking investors there, which technology have actually been disruptive? Like, which ones are actually working today and are being disruptive? I'm not sure. I had some responses in terms of some of these companies doing SPACs and so on. But the thing with those SPAC IPOs is that a lot of it is basically startups that are going public. So it's still very much based on potential. And I'm not sure they had a good answer. You know, I think probably in the precision agriculture space, we're seeing these platforms are getting bigger and bigger. You're seeing these roll-up strategies. So just this week, we had news about Semios has raised $100 million and they're acquiring various other platforms. So I think those digital tools are starting to be, maybe not disruptive is not the right word, but are transforming how farmers operate and work. So it's exciting that we're moving from promise now to actual reality.
I'm so glad you're asking that question because investors and entrepreneurs is because we talk about the promise of technology, but we are not very good at measuring its true impact. And yeah, it's sort of early days, so maybe it's too early to draw any conclusions. But indoor ag is a great example, right? There was so much hype and promise, and then some hard questions being asked about unit economics, as well as the cost of electricity, the viability of it to scale globally in parts of the world where it is you don't have reliable power supply even. So it isn't a one size fits all solution. And over the years, I think what ends up happening though, the companies find use cases and adapt that technology to meet those use cases that perhaps is not what the original promise that they sold consumers or investors for that matter. But, you know, that's just the nature of startups, as you said.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting you said that one size fits all. I think this is a big challenge in food and agriculture because it's not like a consumer technology. It's not like an Uber and Airbnb that's going to be relevant to, you know, a huge number of consumers on the planet. Each different microclimate is going to have think about the carbon question, for instance. Having a carbon monitoring technology, it's going to be needs to be adjusted depending on where you are, depending on the climate, the geography, you know, and so on. And it's the same with, you know, local supply chains operating in different ways and so on. So I think it is quite difficult to create off the bat technologies that are definitely going to be relevant globally and for as big a markets as you want.
I've got a few questions on your thoughts and insights on alternative proteins as that's come to has emerged as this new category that covers everything from plant-based to cell-based to precision fermentation and other new technologies. Let's start with plant-based. Do you think it's going to continue its rocket ship growth through the next decade? Because you look at year-over-year growth, it's obviously outpacing everything else. And then you also look at investment dollars between that and cell-based. It's higher than most other sectors in food tech. What are your thoughts on plant-based and its long-term potential?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I think it absolutely will grow, for sure. Consumers everywhere, you know, are looking for more plant-based alternatives. I'm really interested in a very good plant-based sausage alternative because I have issues, you know, with the pork industry, but I do like to eat sausages. So I think when the companies start to improve their offerings on taste, it's always going to be make them, you know, scalable. My concern with plant-based is the unintended consequences of scaling some of these supply chains, and I referred to it earlier. It's not transformational if you're still going to use a monocropped ingredient like soy that is still going to be grown in the parts of the world where there are questionable practices. That's not transformational. And I worry that startups, you know, in their efforts to scale, and you can't blame them for that, are going to, you know, continue to tap into those markets. So, you know, I'd love to have the conversation more. And you mentioned at the start of our call, you know, my collaboration with Danielle Gould of Food and Tech Connect, and we're working together on a new initiative where we can bring a slightly more nuanced conversation to some of these areas, and plant-based is one of them, to, you know, hope that entrepreneurs coming into this industry not only want to have, you know, that want to replace animal agriculture, but also want to think about how they can be better than existing meat products, how they can be healthier, and, you know, tap into interesting local supply chains potentially, or uplift farmers, take them along with them, you know, and not just necessarily go back to the big commodity houses and get huge amounts of their product from them. I don't know, you know, maybe I'm sounding quite unrealistic and idealistic, but I think now is the time. If we're trying to make a transformation to the food system, let's do it from the outset. So definitely think there's going to be absolutely much more in the plant-based side. I just hope that the next wave of entrepreneurs are really thinking about how to do it, you know, even better.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fascinating area to explore. I myself have spent the better part of this year on this podcast having a number of those conversations. I recently had a deep dive with Bruce Friedrich of GFI, and there's two different visions for the future. And you're right, this the one that you're proposing as an alternative where we don't just talk about replacing animals. We talk about improving the entire system. As much as I think needs to happen, I also see why it's unlikely to happen. I think back at a conversation I had with Ethan Brown from Beyond Meat back in 2017 or 16, it may have been. And I believe I asked him, you know, you say your team researches novel proteins to figure out what functions exactly like meat. You're trying to be the plant-based version of meat, right? You're just trying to create meat. What if you find one, but there is no market for it? There is no supplier for that novel protein. This whole talk of scanning proteins to find the perfect one that can function like meat, it sounds nice, but the reality is you picked pea protein because it was available, you know, and you kind of wanted to avoid soy, which is probably the right decision there. But Impossible, on the other hand, decided to go with GMO soy. So I think it does, from a startup perspective, especially if you're trying to scale quickly and you are a CPG company, you're not the biggest buyer of any particular commodity. And so firstly, your product will turn out to be too expensive if you choose something that is the most sustainable, the best farming practices. And what we end up with is commodity crops now in the form of plant-based burgers versus still definitely a huge improvement from the factory farm meat that we get in the U.S. especially. But, you know, longer term, it's not really that disruptive, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's, you know, absolutely fair enough. And you're right, you know, to make a big impact, but they certainly have, you know, that's the route they needed to go down. But once you've gotten to a certain amount of market share, you've got consumers on board, you know, this isn't going away. You've got a captive audience. Why sort of sometimes dismiss your sourcing practices as not being important because the main goal is replacing animal agriculture? Don't be dismissive. Say, look, this is what we've done now to get to the scale we have, and we're excited about our impact. But we do have this big research initiative that we're working with different suppliers. We've got some tests with growers for these different crops, seeing how we can build up that as a supply. Maybe we're talking to Cargill and seeing how they might be able to help us increase the supply of this other new novel protein and do it alongside it. You know, and if you are going after ESG investors, I would hope that they're supportive of that. But, you know, maybe it's going to hamper the growth projections and so on. But I think they need to think outside the box and think of ways to do both.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, one of the entrepreneurs, I think, who is trying to do that is Miyoko, who does talk about creating local supply chains, regional supply chains, and is putting that upfront in her approach going forward. And she admits they're not there now, but you can't not have that intention, because if you don't, you will never do it, and no one will ever do it. So that's really interesting. I think plant-based has a lot of, as it continues to grow, it'll be interesting to see what new models emerge. I can tell you from my own experience, it's hard to do all the right things when you also have the pressure of growth and scalability. So I totally understand what entrepreneurs go through, but then it doesn't mean because it's hard, we shouldn't try and at least start having that conversation. So kudos to you for doing that. Let's pivot to cell-based now. I guess my question for you is, when is it going to be available? Based on your conversations, what are those timelines looking like? Are they realistic?
I mean, I probably know as much as you do, but I think it looks to me like it's going to be these hybrid products that will be coming first, and that's essentially what just released in Singapore, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that's what they sort of publicly say, but it sounds like there is certainly a significant bit of plant protein involved in their cultivated chicken nuggets. So, I mean, as far as I know, Upside Foods is releasing something early next year. I think it's that cost thing. And I presume you saw that article in The Counter by yep. Joe Fassler, which I think was excellent and really, really well researched. You know, I mean, it sounds quite worrying, frankly, if a lot of that is true about the cost of scaling this. And I think the comparisons made with sort of the vaccination industry and so on were really helpful and useful to look at. Maybe it's always going to be a premium product, or maybe it should be the mainstay of premium food products like foie gras and lobster and some of those animal products that are more expensive. And, you know, particularly horrendous sort of production practices with foie gras, for instance. So people will pay to get a cultivated alternative. You know, maybe it's the premium product, the plant-based will be the cheap product and the cultivated will be an expensive product. I can't really get off them on that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's too many unknowns at this point, and I think we all have to wait and watch. You know, I'm an optimist in general, but I do think we have to have a realistic view of where all of this is going to be and by what time frame, right? So I guess that leads me to my final question, which is, let's look ahead at 2050. What do you think the food system is going to look like then?
Yeah, and I love that you asked me that, because that's something I ask on my podcast. What are a few things that will look different? Well, I think, you know, thinking about cultivated meat, thinking about indoor agriculture, a lot of those technologies have the potential to create these local food systems. And we're sort of at an interesting time now where people want local, clean foods, but then they've also got, you know, these big companies like the Impossibles of the world, which, you know, are providing them some other sort of reason to purchase. But I love the idea of these local food systems. Imagine you're going to have indoor facilities that can grow your vegetables and can grow your hamburgers. And they could be operated by local people. I think one of the missing things when you talk about eating for the planet is, you know, we talk a lot about the environmental, but we also must talk about the social situation, because there are a lot of people working on farms, working in the food system that, you know, have terrible conditions. You know, you hear horror stories about people, farm workers coming from Mexico, doing backbreaking work, living in awful conditions. And similarly with food workers, a lot that's come out with the pandemic is how poorly they're treated. So I love the idea of local food systems that can involve the local community. There's a lot, you know, around circular economy. I think we're starting to scratch the surface of incorporating new buildings, having some food grown on the roofs and using the heating and so on. So can it be aspirational? But I think that, you know, that could be a very real, a real reality there, you know. And if you have, I think I'll just stop there. So that's one thing that I think will be different. Again, you know, aspirational and hopeful is that regenerative agriculture will be more mainstream. And something I could have referred to earlier when talking about the route that a lot of these plant-based companies could go down. But that's a real opportunity, especially if you're going to be potentially thinking about some novel crops and novel ingredients, but really start creating that from the core and have these regenerative growing systems. And whether or not that, you know, there's carbon markets attached to that, I'm a bit skeptical about carbon markets. They've tried them in the past and they haven't necessarily worked. But overall, making, you know, having better communities around how those plant-based proteins are grown would be brilliant. And then I think having a consumer that's more engaged. So having more information. Now, you know, we could go down the route of talking about labeling, because that, again, could be something that might, you know, might not be helpful. But having consumers that are more engaged, really understand where their food is from. Maybe they have a QR code, or maybe something fancier than that in 2050. But, I really think that will be it. And especially if you've got more of these local food systems.
Mm. Hopefully blockchain will solve that, whatever that is. I'm still trying to figure it out. But, you know, that's a great answer. I really appreciate your time today. Enjoy this conversation. And I really enjoy reading your reporting as well. Thank you for all that you do covering this space.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You've been listening to Eat for the Planet with Nil Zacharias. If you enjoyed this conversation and would like to show your support, all you have to do is subscribe to this show and rate and review it. To learn more about this podcast or my work, go to eftp.co. That's eftp.co. Thank you for listening.